Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Lizeth Baron Carvajal, a host of the channel. Today, I will be talking to Jean Jackson about her wonderful book, Managing Multiculturalism, Indigeneity, and the Struggle for Rights in Colombia, published by Stanford University Press in 2019. Welcome, Jean. Thank you for talking to me today. It's so great to have you.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to participate.
Wonderful. So you are an emerita professor of anthropology at MIT, and you have conducted research in Colombia for more than 50 years, if I'm correct. So this is remarkable and something that is powerfully conveyed in this book, because you talk about your research in all of these years. But before we talk about the book, can you tell us a little bit about how you came to study anthropology and focus specifically on indigenous groups in Colombia?
Well, I think I decided to go on to graduate school in anthropology when I spent my junior year in Spain in 63-64. And so I went to graduate school, and it seemed preordained that I would work in Latin America because I spoke Spanish, and I had been to Mexico and loved it. And during my work at Stanford, I became interested in medical anthropology. And so I wanted to find a region where the communities had had as little as possible exposure to Western medicine. So that's how I ended up in the region of Colombia that's right on the border with Brazil and right on the equator, which is called the Vaupés. Vaupés in Spanish.
Wonderful. I think I read that you initially were thinking of focusing on Brazil instead of Colombia.
Oh, yes. But this was 1968, and there was serious scandals happening in Brazil over land grabs and horrible violence to indigenous communities there. So the anthropologists I spoke to, both in this country and a couple in Brazil, said, do not go right now, because nobody will give you permission to go into the region you want to work in, which was the Northwest Amazon. You'll just cool your heels in Belém or Manaus or, you know, someplace like that. So at the very last minute, I had been studying Portuguese intensively. I contacted people in Venezuela and Peru and Ecuador and Colombia, and Alicia Luzan de Reichel wrote back saying welcome and gave me a long list of things to buy. So that's how I ended up in Colombia.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And, you know, it's such a great thing that you've conducted research for this long period of time, because now we can see in this book how your thinking has evolved, the challenges you faced. So tell us more about this book. So maybe it's because I'm a historian and I'm not usually accustomed to reading such self-reflexive work, which I know is a characteristic of anthropology as a discipline. But it's wonderful just to read how your thought has changed over this period of time, and how you even discuss some mistakes you made along the way. And you always situate your choices scholarly and about, you know, your research choices in very concrete historical moments. So how you came to this book and, you know, did you envision you were going to write this book as you did?
Well, first of all, reflexive writing in anthropology did not at all characterize it until the postmodernist trend began in the mid-1980s. Before that, anthropology was trying to be a positivist social science and collect data and concern itself with rigorous methodologies and so on and so forth. It was only in the prefaces to that basically anthropologists would talk about, you know, doing field work. And some of them wrote separate books. But the reflexive part and the ethnographic part were for the most part, kept distinct. And then with, you know, this linguistic turn where people looked at writing and looked and critiqued those methodologies, anthropologists started writing more experimentally and more reflexively. And my purpose was to, in this book, to show how anthropology is done, how anthropology works, so to speak, the process of field work, to give an example of one ethnographer's journey and an example of the, you know, sometimes flying by the seat of your pants or, you know, having to change your research proposal very radically because, you know, a revolution happens or something like that. And to bring some of the epistemological, the ethical, the methodological issues that we face to the fore so that readers can understand a little bit, again, just from one set of examples, how you actually conduct ethnography and write ethnography.
Yeah, no, and I think this is what makes your book so wonderful, and it can be useful, I guess. I mean, more broadly of like, it's about ethnography, but I think it's a great example of how to think ethically and the challenges we may face. So I think it can be useful for many different audiences. And you have so many different examples that it's such a nice read.
Good.
So this book, you told us, follows the long trajectory of your research. And you do this as a way to explore the evolution of the country's indigenous movement. So you were there when the things were happening, when major changes were occurring. So before we delve into the specific parts of your argument and your concepts, I wonder if you can situate the case of Colombia in a broader perspective, as you do in the introduction of your book. What are those events, international organizations, state actors that our listeners should be aware of in order to understand the history an evolution of Colombia's indigenous movement in the second half of the 20th century? And how does Colombia compare to other countries of the region?
Well, the first thing I would say is that the Cold War was coming to an end, and the countries in the West were reevaluating how they were going to deal with the Soviet Union and with the Third World. That's the backdrop to an awful lot of what is the backdrop to my book. The presence of multiculturalism. Many Latin American states during this period were undergoing what's called the democratic transition, and there were many revisions. There were just new constitutions being written. I think maybe 15 countries engaged in this process. Colombia never had a revolution, unlike several other countries, and it has been a putative democracy, although that needs an awful lot of qualification. But other countries had more experiences of dictators and a lack of democracy for periods of time. Unfortunately, the Colombian state has always been quite weak and subject to all kinds of disruptions. And a big difference between that country and other countries is the 50-year-long civil war, which some people don't want to call a civil war, so we can call it an internal armed conflict. And that just has meant played an enormous role in the issues and the events that I, you know, pay attention to. But like these other countries, it did go through a democratic transition in the sense of very far-reaching constitutional reform. But again, with the backdrop of the armed conflict, making just the country experienced this transition in rather some rather different respects because of that armed conflict backdrop.
Yeah, and what about in terms of comparing Colombia's indigenous population to the indigenous populations of other Latin American countries? Because you make a really important comparison with places like Mexico or like Bolivia. So what can you tell our listeners about that so they can understand how big was this indigenous movement in terms of how many people are indigenous in Colombia?
Right. Geography plays a role as well as demography. There are some countries in Latin America, Guatemala and Ecuador, Mexico, that have much larger indigenous populations. Colombia is on the same order as Brazil, Argentina, with very small numbers. Colombia is between 3.5 and 4% with the qualification that census records don't always, are not always accurate. I'll leave it at that. With respect to geography, Colombia has both highland and lowland indigenous communities. Brazil does not. So it is an Andean country along with Ecuador and Bolivia and Peru. I contrast the development of official indigenism, which is an assimilationist project that states undertake with respect to their indigenous communities. I compare Mexico and Colombia. Comparison is useful. The contrasts are quite pronounced. I won't go into that now because it's complex. But the fact that Colombia has a very small group of indigenous communities and that some of them are in highland areas and therefore not dispersed and therefore politically much more adept at organizing is a very important feature of Colombia's what has transpired. I would argue that a small percentage of indigenous communities was actually a favorable component of organizing because unlike Guatemala and Bolivia in particular, you didn't have all of this rhetoric, sometimes extremely sensationalistic, about the indigenous threat, which you find in very, very blatant, bold terms in both of those other countries.
Yeah. And I think one of the other very important factors you mentioned is that indigenous community in Colombia gained collective ownership of almost 30% of the national territory, right? Which is remarkable given those demographics you just described.
It's astounding. And to understand that, and I don't completely understand it yet, is quite a challenge because it is so remarkable. But I would add that these are items on paper and in computers. The proof of the pudding is looking at actual territories and what's happening in them. And the picture is quite bleak in a lot of areas of Colombia. You have mega hydroelectric projects, you have military bases, you have all kinds, and then you'd have just outright lack of control by state security forces. One branch of the guerrilla group FARC, Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia, there's one branch that's a dissident branch, and they're still controlling large area in Amazonas, the Amazonas. So again, you know, you have official what's legally established, and then you have to look at what's actually happening on the ground.
Yeah, and we can see that contrast in your book beautifully. So for listeners, if they're intrigued by this fact that indigenous people have collective ownership of over 30% or 30% of national territory in Colombia, but, you know, also understand the inequalities, all of these things you just mentioned, they should just go on and read the book. So let's move on and talk about some of the main concepts of your book, because you devote a significant part of your introduction to talk about concepts. So let's start with identity. So how do you conceptualize identity in the book? How have your understandings of identity changed in the course of your career? And here I would like to tie this discussion with another very important concept, which is indigeneity. So what is indigeneity and how is that different from indigenousness? So tell us more about this.
Well, I'm particularly interested in social identity, and that's defined as all the groups and categories that one belongs to. I'll also add that quite a number of social scientists think that you cannot come up with a useful overarching definition of identity. It's just wieldy. And I work with that notion of social identity in the context of politics. Identity politics is the phrase. And so I don't explore an awful lot of what other theorists and ethnographers work with respect to this very, very large abstract notion. And as you just pointed out, I'm particularly interested with respect to the area of identity politics, looking at the issue of indigenous identity. It's a very thorny area to think about and to research in. And it's also obviously a very sensitive area to do anthropological research in. There are several reasons for this. As I point out, the word indigeneity is a new word. Of course, it comes from indigenous. Indigenous just means of a particular place, you know, originates in a particular place, an indigenous plant, an indigenous animal. It has not been moved, has not migrated. Or if it has migrated, it's spoken of as indigenous to that other territory. So that's the idea. It's the idea of autochthony, original to a particular place. In the Western Hemisphere, prior to European arrival, there were peoples in the Western Hemisphere, and they came to be called Indians or indigenous, but we also know that there are indigenous movements throughout the rest of the world. And it's fascinating to see how indigeneity gets worked on, debated over, and subjected to legal and jurisprudential policies in the rest of the world, because it is quite different. People in Africa, you know, we'll say we're all indigenous, but there still are small groups, small communities in Africa who claim to be indigenous within those larger states, like Kenya, Tanzania, and so forth. In the Western Hemisphere, this notion of Indianness, indigenousness, is pretty widely accepted. But what that consists of, apart from descent from earlier peoples who lived here before, here being the Western Hemisphere, before the arrival of the Europeans, is very, very complex. The other notions are association with the territory in many areas, of course, some kind of notion of genetic relatedness. But these are very, very abstract. And if you want to get into other concepts associated in some circles with indigeneity, you'll start talking about ideas about spirituality and so forth, more cultural and social notions. I use the concept indigeneity because it does stand in for this very complex set of issues that I'm trying to discuss. But people should remember that it's a new concept and its connection to the idea of indigenous, which is a very broad idea.
Perfect. And that's super clear in the introduction. So for our listeners, if they want to learn more about indigeneity, there's a subsection there that you can go and consult. So let's now talk about two other central concepts, which are multiculturalism and neoliberalism. So multiculturalism, as you tell us, is an ideology that celebrates and works to protect ethnic and cultural diversity. Meanwhile, neoliberalism seeks to dismantle the welfare state through economic restructuring and market-driven governance. So neoliberalism reconceptualizes the person. Political subjects now fashion themselves through market logics of competition and efficiency. In a way, I think this may seem to contradict some of those ideas about indigeneity that present indigenous people as subjects driven by collective action or as stewards of the environment that oppose capitalist development. But you tell us that multiculturalism and neoliberalism do not necessarily oppose one another, and that economic austerity and pro-market reforms have actually been accompanied by pro-democracy and multicultural agendas. So what is the relationship between neoliberalism and multiculturalism? Do they need one another to exist? Is multiculturalism always necessarily neoliberal?
So multiculturalism, I think we should distinguish the general concept, and you just gave a good definition, with official multiculturalism. This is state, for the most part, state-promoted multicultural legislation, policies, and their implementation. Yes, multiculturalism seeks to recognize difference and say to groups that are different in a particular country, please join and become full-fledged citizens, but you will be citizens with special rights, the right to difference. We are no longer going to stigmatize or discriminate against your difference. Unity through diversity is our project. But of course, once legislation is enacted, what's going on is the state is seeking to discriminate and choose to dissect, if you want, and choose which groups are to be recognized officially and seen as entitled to state special services in the areas of health or education or not having to serve in the military or whatever. The link between official multiculturalism, because NGOs will have their own multiculturalist agendas, and the indigenous movement certainly has its, you know, set of agendas, and those aren't necessarily directly linked to neoliberalism. Indirectly, yes, they are, because eventually the funders for NGOs quite often have very clearly discernible neoliberal logics behind, their choices for funding. Official multiculturalism enacts its multiculturalist policies because of the opening up in Colombia. It happened in the early 90s of neoliberal moves. Well, it happened before, such as structural adjustment and dismantling the corporatist state. quite often seen as corrupt and bloated and just not working well at all. And that kind of accusation was leveled at many Latin American states in the 70s and 80s. So the opening up to a marketized notion of governance and relaxing, deregulating all kinds of institutions and laws connected to the corporatist state did open up spaces for various groups. And they can be religious groups as well as indigenous and Afro-descendant groups to cut their own deals, to work directly, for example, with an international NGO, or, you know, they didn't have to necessarily work through state agencies, which sometimes would simply just siphon off whatever funds were coming in. So that's one example of the linkages that that you can find between neoliberal logics and multiculturalism. There are a number of scholars who mount very powerful critiques of Link, which, as you point out, on the surface, they don't seem to necessarily be linked at all. One is, you know, a fight for justice and recognition, and the other is dismantling, you know, what is perceived of as unworkable and corrupt governments. And one very good criticism comes from anthropologist Charles Hale, who writes that recognition of the right to culture very often is accompanied by just denial of a recognition of other problems that poor communities, poor urban, poor rural communities face: oppression, poverty itself, you know, very corrupt state security forces, what have you. And you certainly can see evidence, you know, supporting his argument in many, many Latin American countries.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like: no fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, wonderful. I mean, I think our listeners have a great read ahead if they're interested in this relationship between multiculturalism and neoliberalism. So I guess now that we have discussed some of those foundations, I think it's a good time to move to the chapters. Just to flag it to our listeners, your book is divided in 5 chapters, followed by a conclusion. And these chapters develop your broader interventions and include at times multiple ethnographic cases. So this makes this book such a wonderful read because it incorporates many different examples and it truly shows your academic trajectory of more than 50 years. So I think for just context, let's start with chapter 1, which is titled Indigenous Colombia. So in this chapter, you provide a history of indigenous organizing in Colombia, the discussions that led to the Constitution of 1991, the year in which I was born. So for me, that Constitution is like it's like I'm a daughter of that time. Okay, and so you also give a brief introduction to the country's Afro-Colombians. So maybe you can tell our listeners about this history, you know, about some of its landmarks, some of the important actors, it's a lot. I know it's a long history. And for those who want to know more details, they should go and read that chapter. But what are some of the important things that happen in this history? And what is the distinction between, or the connection between, ethnicity and race in the case of Colombia?
Well, I'd start off by saying an ancestral figure, Manuel Quintín Lame, during the 20s, broke with both the left and the right. He started off being very interested in Marxism, but he broke. And that is the first kind of nationwide example of indigenous organizing. He died too early to see the fruits of his labor, really come into bloom in the 70s and 80s. But he really is a foundational figure. The Constitution, and there were lots of reforms before the Constitution, is the most far-reaching in Latin America with respect to indigenous rights. And I have to point out that there are under 4% of the population is indigenous, and up to 30% of Colombia's population is Afro-descendant. Of course, how you define that and provide evidence is very complicated. But between, let's say, 15 to 30% is Afro-descendant. That's the largest proportion in all of Spanish-speaking Latin America. Brazil, of course, has a higher proportion. So there's really quite a contrast if you look at the Constitution, where indigenous rights and so forth are mentioned really many times, maybe 20, and Afro-descendant populations are basically not mentioned at all. There's a transitory article. Later on, legislation was passed giving certain amounts of recognition to Afro-descendant communities, but the contrast between those two, I'll just call them ethnic groups or ethno-racial groups, is stark. The issue of ethnicity versus race is one, of course, that is much broader than what happens in Colombia. And there's been a huge amount of literature on race recently in the last 15 years, I would say. The differences between indigenous mobilizing and the responses that activists were met with is remarkable. Activists were like rock stars. They were on TV. They were on the front page of the newspapers. There was a moment in which, for various reasons, including the armed conflict and the rise of multiculturalism, indigeneity, indigenous people were just seen as representing all kinds of good things, as opposed to 20 years before, when there were massacres wiping out entire communities. And the differences are important to understand. One difference is how Afro-descendant populations are seen. Quite often they're seen in stark contrast to indigenous. Of course, in reality, there are many people who are descended from both. We're talking about representation. We're not talking about actual populations. In Colombia, with a few exceptions on the coast, small communities on the Pacific coast, Afro-descendants are seen as subjects, as Colombians, and quite often that's how they want to be seen, or as people living in a particular region, or as mestizo peasants. The history of attempts to get Afro-descendant populations in Colombia to jump on the bandwagon and promote you know, their cause, their fights for land and other resources and for dignity and so forth, is a very different story from Indigenous mobilizing and activists and their allies. And one reason behind that is that Indigenous people are seen as descending from autochthonous populations that were here before the Europeans arrived, whereas, as we know, African descendant people, their ancestors go back to Africa. So Afro-descendant mobilizing has a challenge in that if you stress the cultural implications of the people you're descended from, it does not locate you in Colombia. It locates you in Africa. And this doesn't work politically. So that's the difference. The other difference is the lack, apart from blackness, the lack of other characteristics that can be seen as unifying Colombia's Afro-descendant population. There are people in very rural areas, but most Afro-descendants live in urban areas and so forth. Another reason is that indigeneity is very often linked to ethnicity, to culture, and Afro-descendants is linked to genetics, to in terms of recognition to physiognomy, and again, in terms of origins in this other patient. This is not reality. In fact, Indigenous populations are very often racialized, but it's more convenient to kind of say, well, that happened in the past, but we're beyond that now. We don't discriminate anymore. Afro-descendant populations, different collectivities of them have culturally distinctive practices and so forth, but they are much more likely to be conceptualized in terms of race. And as I just said, there's a continuum there. Afro-descendant people in the cities are very often just seen as kind of standard issue Colombians who are dark skinned. And then the populations in the rural areas and the Pacific coast are granted, you know, much more ethnicity. But it's an interesting contrast to work through, because the history during the colonial period and after independence of the official treatment of these two populations also reveals important contrasts that have lasted down to the present.
Yeah, and I think it's such an interesting contrast, and I really liked reading about it in your book. So let's move to chapter two, which is titled Tucanoan Culture and the Issue of Culture. And here, culture is in quotes. So here you tell us about your first research experience in Colombia when you came to study the Tucanoans, a group of indigenous people straddling the border between Colombia and Brazil, and that inhabit what is known as the Vaupés region, which is something you said already. So I think our listeners would love to hear about how you're thinking about Tucanoan culture evolved over time, but also how you address important critiques from a fellow anthropologist and local activist. And here, I think a lot had to do with this concept of culture that is so important for anthropology. I mean, for many other disciplines too, but in anthropology is particularly salient. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about this chapter and about that question you pose, that is, how to conduct research on sensitive topics, even at times being critical to the actors you're analyzing, without inciting opprobrium in scholarly and activist communities. So what did you learn from that experience that other researchers keep in mind?
Well, I think I learned that what you just said is impossible. I certainly didn't find out a way to get around those challenging ethical and methodological, epistemological issues. I'm not going to go into my original research because it's just way too complex. The part of the chapter that I will mention has to do with the politics of culture or cultural politics, which has to do with this multicultural emphasis on recognition of difference, of cultural difference. And in the Valpaise, which has between 85 to 95% indigenous population, it became the recipient of a great deal of funding coming from the state and from Europe and Canada. And I mean, it really was remarkable because lots of these NGOs and government agencies genuinely wanted to help, you know, these isolated populations who had been pretty much ignored by the state and under the tutelage of the Catholic Church until these reforms started happening. I was particularly interested in a local organization, I'll just call it CRIVA, which actually was midwife by the local Catholic missionaries to fight off debt peonage due to the rubber gathering, and also to give grief to their Protestant missionary rivals. And so you had a local organization that did not arise out of the grassroots and did not arise out of their own particular issues, their own particular problems. And this organization is extremely interesting because, unfortunately, it represents a lot of the unintended consequences of official multiculturalist plans that are developed in, you know, the big city of Bogota and farther away. And then they have to be adjusted and they play out in very different local contexts. So what I looked at was how these activists in Mitu, the capital, were finding out about how best to represent their culture in ways that outsiders, and this included other indigenous communities in Colombia who were producing the majority of activists, i.e. highland communities, Andean communities, and they began presenting Tucanoan culture, that's the name of the groups that inhabit the Valpaise, in a way that was understandable because of received wisdom of what Amazonian indigenous communities looked like. And in some extremely important respects, Tucanoans did not look like the stereotype of Amazonian communities. So that got me very interested, and I started, you know, documenting ways in which this received wisdom was being attached to discussions of how Tucanoans lived and what they thought and what and their values and so on and so forth. And that's what got me into trouble, because of course I looked like this outsider gringa anthropologist, you know, criticizing a mobilized organization that was fighting for its place in the sun and for dignity and recognition and so on and so forth. And that in the book, you know, brings up larger issues of just what anthropology is supposed to do in contexts that are diplomatically challenging and about extremely sensitive topics. Politics is always, at least potentially, extremely sensitive. There can be an awful lot at stake. And as we know, quite often politically motivated representations fall a bit short of reality. Boy, we can certainly see that in this country right now. So that's what I talk about, you know, what are my loyalties to? because I don't want to just accept every assertion that an activist makes. That's not fair to the communities that that activist claims to represent, but sometimes, you know, is just not representing adequately at all. And also, you know, you're writing for the record. And I had spent quite a bit of time in the late 60s with an Indigenous community, and had, you know, I certainly make no claims to a great deal of knowledge, but I did listen to people and write down what they told me about their values and their culture.
Yeah. But I must say, I really appreciate this self-reflexive part of your book, because I think as scholars, we can all, you know, experience challenges, pushback, you know, have differences with other scholars or activists. And so your book is a great tool, I think, to think about these challenges.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to skip, just for our listeners, for them to know, we're going to skip chapters 3 and 4 because we're running out of time, but not, they are wonderful. So I advise them to go and check them out. Chapter 3 is titled The State's Presence in the Balpés Increases, and chapter 4 is titled The Indigenous Movement and Rights. Here you cover very different topics, legal pluralism, you discuss more national policies developed in Bogotá and then implemented locally. So there's a lot of things to discuss here that our listeners can later on go on and read in your book. So I would like to finish off with discussing chapter 5, which is titled Reindigenization and Its Discontents. And here you discuss several examples of communities working to recover their indigenous identity. So I just wonder if you may talk about some of these examples, and particularly those projects that occurred in urban areas. So because, as you said, sometimes indigeneity is associated with rural areas and with the assumption that indigenous rights are necessarily attached to a territory. So tell us about this. And just to flag it to our listeners, I think the cover of your book is actually a picture of one of these urban cabildos, the Bosa Cabildo headquarters. Correct.
That's right.
So tell us more about these efforts of re-indigenization.
Okay, well, the contrast is back to the concept of indigeneity. And here the question is, are you indigenous now, or are you just of indigenous descent? And as we know, in Latin America, many, many people can claim, should they so choose, to be partially descended from ancestors who were here before the arrival of the Europeans. That's a big contrast to the notion of whitening, where European descent was seen as, you know, much, much more valuable. And the shift is absolutely worth studying of the valorization of indigenousness. So there are lots and lots of communities throughout the country who are petitioning and who have petitioned, some of them successfully, most of them not, to be recognized as officially an indigenous community. It used to be kind of automatic. You were indigenous if you were residing in a resguardo, which is a reserve. But now it's much, much more complicated, because with multiculturalism and the Constitution and all the subsequent legislation, there are many benefits to being seen as a recognized indigenous community. So there's a struggle going on between state agencies and these petitioner communities. With respect to the urban case, it's extremely interesting because of this link that is at the back of people's minds, even though they might not be aware of it. There's a link between, shall we say, legitimate indigenous identity and territory. And of course, in urban areas, indigenous people residing there are usually seen as having migrated in. But these Muisca communities, and there are five of them in sections of Bogota and its surrounds, claim that they're still on the land that their ancestors were on. Just the city has dispossessed them, but, you know, they still, their umbilical cords are buried in the ground and their ancestors are in the local cemeteries and so on. So it's quite interesting because here you have a claim of territory and you have a claim of descent. And you have a claim of culture. And these Muisca communities, and by the way, Muisca are a very well-known colonial and pre-Columbian population that is, they're mentioned a great deal in the colonial records, and their language is a great deal of material about their language. But they disappeared officially around the sometime in the 18th century. So this is a reclamation project, reclamation of identity and claims accruing to that identity. And I looked very briefly at two of these communities and their efforts to live lives with dignity under extremely difficult circumstances, dangerous circumstances, and to receive recognition from the state and to receive recognition from people who will make all kinds of disparaging comments. You know, you're just our neighbors. There's nothing different about you. Where's your language? So on and so forth. I have been impressed by these, the two that I visited, with their efforts, you know, to fight at times, you know, very powerful interests from private corporations trying to do mega land grabs and from state and municipal sectors as well. So I do find this part of the book quite interesting and quite moving.
Yeah, I also think it's super interesting. And for our listeners, you know, this is chapter 5. There are many topics that we couldn't cover. So this is an opportunity for them to go and buy the book. But before I let you go, we arrived to the conclusion of the book and here you recapitulate your main interventions. But I wonder, you know, if there's anything that you think that is worth mentioning that we haven't discussed yet. And more generally, I just want to ask you, how do you think your book as a whole is important for those interested in indigenous movements in Colombia, but also elsewhere? So I cannot help to think about, and what when you discuss the difference between the legal recognition and the actual situation of indigenous communities, I cannot help to think about the cases of sexual violence against indigenous girls that have surfaced in the past few months in Colombia. So how multiculturalism cohabits with persistent inequalities and violence. So I just want to ask you if there's anything you want our listeners to hear before we let you go.
Yes, a couple of things. One is, I emphasize in the book, there are two projects that need to be kept distinct. One is analysis, where you're really trying to understand something. And the other is applying judgment, looking at whether something is good or bad. Now, we engage in both of these efforts, and they're both important. But I would ask people to be clear when you know, you're doing the one or you're doing the other, because very often things get messed up, and people think that, you know, you're applying a value judgment when actually you're trying desperately to find the neutral language and just describe something as it unfolds, you know, in a particular place at a particular time. Yes, with respect to the current situation, apart from Colombia, I mean, the kinds of femicide that happen in Mexico, many of those women are indigenous, but that's not quite, you know, in northern Mexico, there is horrible, horrible sexual depredations, violence, rape, you name it, throughout Latin America. And quite often, the women have very little recourse. It's just not a safe situation they find themselves in. It's absolutely horrible. Another very unfortunate phenomenon is suicide. In the Valpais, youth suicide is very high. It's extremely upsetting. And those kinds of issues need to be kept, you know, uppermost in our minds when, you know, we're analyzing and trying to find solutions. Colombia, in the indigenous movement, indigenous communities have seen remarkable changes, but there is a long road ahead before you can have anything approximating justice and just plain old security for many people who find themselves in extremely precarious situations.
Yeah, that is a very saddening truth. And I hope, things change. And I hope our listeners buy your book, read the book. It's a wonderful read. Just before finishing off, we usually like to ask you, is there anything you're working on right now? Do you have any projects?
I'm in a kind of hiatus. My partner died. He didn't die of COVID-19. He was 91 years old, but he died in May. And I'm basically dealing with his death and the memorials. It's going to be a Zoom service, of course, and things like that. That's the space I'm in now. So I've put my own research on hold until I feel more like getting back to it.
Yeah, I understand that. And I offer you my condolences. I also lost a loved one in Colombia, so I understand. So,
yes, Jean, thank you.
I mean, under those circumstances, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Yeah, you're really welcome. You're very welcome.
This was wonderful.
I enjoyed it a great deal.
Thank you so much.